Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for an hour each weekday afternoon. We take your phone calls. We have an open line. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, this is one place you can call and raise them for conversation. There may be other places, but this is one place, and you can maybe you'll get an answer if you call here. Maybe you won't. It depends on whether you ask me something I know about or not. And so that's always an open question until you ask. But there's a very good chance if you have a Bible question, we can get it answered here. You can also call if you have a difference of opinion from the host and want to improve on an answer that has been given previously to somebody else. So you can call about that as well. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Our first caller today is Jonas from Northridge, California. Jonas, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I've called you in the past before. I'm a former Seventh-day Adventist that has studied his way out of many errors. Mm-hmm. But I'm having trouble sorting through one issue in particular. Adventists teach that Christ's moral backbone, the human part of his personhood, was that of a fallen person. In other words, he had no greater innate ability to obey any more than we do. And therefore, we should be able to produce perfect obedience by depending upon God, just as Christ was able to do so. So if you could help me sort through the errors in that thinking, or if it's an acceptable variation on Christian theology, but I'd like to hear you speak on that.
Okay, well, I know Edward Irving back in the 1900s was branded as a heretic for teaching that he believed, he was not a Seventh-day Adventist, but he believed that Jesus had a sinful nature from birth. And I don't know if that's what the Seventh-day Adventist teaching is, that Jesus had a sinful nature, or if simply that in his human nature, he had no advantages over us in our human nature. We do have a fallen nature, which is subject to pain and suffering and death. Jesus did have a human nature that was subject to those things too. And we could say that was a result of being fallen. So we could say his human nature was indeed in the form of a fallen human being. That's why he was mortal and could die. And it does say in Galatians 4 that Jesus was born in the likeness of human, of sinful flesh. I don't think it's Galatians 4 after all. I'm thinking of another verse, but the Bible does say that he was born in the likeness of sinful flesh. Now, it doesn't mean he was sinful, but sinful flesh or fallen flesh is born with certain characteristics, especially certain physical weaknesses and immortality. And Jesus was born in that form, too. Now, he wasn't just a man, however. He wasn't just a man in a body that was living under the conditions of the fall. He was God taking on human form. Now, that does not mean that it was just God wearing a costume of a man. And there's all kinds of ways people have looked at this, and the Bible doesn't explain it for us. But it's not that just, you know, God was walking around wearing a costume of a human being, but he actually took on the human nature. He was born through the human family from Adam's offspring so that he'd be actually one of us. Now, how God can do that is not really known to us very well, and we don't know what all that involves once he's here. We do know that Jesus, although he was God in the flesh and never sinned, he was nonetheless tempted. Now, the Bible says that God is not tempted with evil, neither does he tempt any man. So, if God is not tempted, but Jesus was, then we can say, although Jesus never sinned and he was holy, he was apparently subject to temptation, like the rest of us. In fact, the Bible says he was tempted in all ways like we are, and yet without sin. We know he got tired. God never slumbers nor sleeps, but Jesus got tired and fell asleep on a number of occasions recorded. We know that Jesus was not omniscient because there were things he didn't know. He actually admitted to not knowing at least one thing. He said only the Father knows that. The Son and the angels don't even know that. And so he was not omniscient. He was not omnipresent when he was in the body. He was in one place at a time, and even spoke about his being absent from certain places. Like when Lazarus died, Jesus said to his disciples, "I'm glad I was not there so that you might believe." So we find Jesus testifying that he was not omniscient, not omnipresent, not even omnipotent, but he was God. Now, how can someone be God and not be all those things? Well, this is apparently, I mean, we don't really have an explanation of this, but this is apparently what is involved when God takes on human nature. He has to trim himself down to our size in a certain sense. He's still the same being. He's still the same personality, the same character, but he's kind of, I just say, trimmed himself down. The way it says it in Philippians chapter 2 is he emptied himself. It says he exists in the form of God, and he emptied himself and took on the form of a servant. Now, I don't know that any of this dovetails with what you learned as a Seventh-day Adventist or in one way or the other. I'm not sure what is meant to say that Jesus' flesh, his human side, was fallen as much as ours. But if it just means subject to death, subject to temptation and so forth, then it would appear that that is true. Subject to weariness, even subject to starvation, because when he fasted for 40 days, the Bible says he was hungry. And of course, after someone fasts for 40 days and they get hungry, they're at the point of starvation. So I guess I wouldn't see it as a heresy, depending on what it means. Now, if it means that Jesus was as prone to sin as the rest of us, I don't think the Bible tells us that is true, and therefore I wouldn't affirm it. He was different than us because he was God in the flesh, but he was different than God out of the flesh because he was in the flesh, and taking on human flesh brought certain handicaps with it. I know that to say that he was subject to temptation, which he apparently was because he was tempted in all points like we are, does suggest that he had as much free choice as we do about doing the right thing or the wrong thing, and he always chose right. He never chose wrong. Now, whether he did that just because he was a great man who trusted in his Father more than any other men, or whether it's because God in him, you know, simply couldn't go another way, is one of those theological points that no doubt one view or the other might be considered to be the orthodox view, but the Bible actually doesn't discuss it. And so I'm not going to bust Ellen G. White on what she said, as you've quoted it to, because I'm not sure how she meant it. She might have meant it in a way I would disagree with, but she might have meant it in a way that I would not necessarily disagree with. So I'm not going to pile on her about that. I certainly have my differences with Ellen G. White on many things, but I'm not sure that that's one of the things. It depends on where she goes with it. You know, it depends on what application she makes of it. It might clarify how she means it. But the way you worded it, it didn't seem to me like it was necessarily heretical, although it could well be that there would be some who would think it is. It doesn't necessarily contradict any biblical verse I know. Oh, are you still there? I guess not. I'm sorry, I was thinking you were still on the line. Okay, our next caller is Cheryl from Everett, Washington. Cheryl, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks, Steve. Good afternoon. I've been listening to a lot of your lectures online, and I appreciate them. One thing I've been thinking about lately, and I don't know if you address in your lectures, is for those of us who are saved after the new heavens and the earth come, does it anywhere in the Bible say what happens to those we loved or what happens, what our memories would be of them? Because if they're not, the way I'm looking at it, it's, even though they may not be saved, someone I loved, family member, friend, or whoever, who I reached out to and tried to, you know, show them the love of Christ,
mm-hmm.
if they never accepted, they still shaped me.
What our psychological attitude will be toward those who are lost, or how we will have been affected by it in some permanent way. Well, all of our interactions with people who are lost are part of our experience, just like all of our interactions with people who are saved. That is, life has, we have 24 hours a day of experiences, 7 days a week. And those experiences are fed to us through a stream of events that we react to one way or the other. Our reactions have a lot to do with what we become. If what we are enjoying is a pleasant thing, we might become complacent. We might become proud. We might become, you know, worldly. On the other hand, we might react differently. We might be thankful to God, and we might be rejoicing in Him and sharing the blessing with other people. You know, the circumstance itself does not determine how we will turn out, but what we react to. Likewise, if we're sick, you know, in pain, poor, you know, well, that can turn people bitter against God, but they can also make a choice to trust in God and to look to God and to thank God in their tribulation, which is what the Bible says Christians do. Now, your dealings with people are all part of that. People either are pleasing to you or unpleasing. People bless you or they don't bless you. Some people persecute you. What people do, the saved and the unsaved in your life, all are components of the circumstances of your life that you're reacting to one way or another. So if you're asking, how will you be different in the new heavens and the new earth because of people in your life who are unsaved, I'm not sure that can be predicted, except to say that everyone you've ever had contact with has been for you an opportunity to express the love of God or not. Perhaps every person you've met has been a temptation to you to be impatient or an opportunity to be patient, to absorb injuries and insults or not. I mean, there's all kinds of experiences we have with people, and those experiences shape us, or I should say, our responses to those experiences shape us. Now, I was thinking at first that you were asking a somewhat different question. I'm not sure if I'm asking the question
that's part of it, but I think also about, is there anything in the Bible that would point out, will we remember these people because of the way it shaped us in our experiences?
Right. The Bible doesn't say what we will remember and what we will not remember. Some people, especially those who believe in the traditional view of hell, that hell is a place of eternal torment consciously, some people would say, God will wipe that from our memory so that we don't have to think about our grandmothers and grandfathers who were lost being tormented forever and ever. And you know, that would kind of spoil the bliss of heaven if we knew about it. And so God will wipe our memories clean of that. I don't know of anything in the Bible that says he'll do that. And I'm not really sure that that would speak well of God. If when I am in his presence and know him fully, if there are things he still has to hide from me about his actions, or else I would be unhappy with him, then there's something wrong with him, it seems to me. If I, when I am perfected, would still object to something he's doing, and therefore he has to not let me know about it, he has to wipe it from my memory, then it seems to me like he's not completely honest. And it seems to me like then, in fact, I will have to be, there will be things I know about God now that I won't know then, because I know about hell now. But if I don't know about it then I'm going to know less about God when I see him face to face than I know now, while I'm just reading in the Bible. That doesn't seem to make sense to me, that he'd wipe that from our memory. Now, there are some people who believe the traditional view of hell, like Tertullian, the church father, who said that we'll think like God thinks, and therefore we'll be very much aware of our relatives and loved ones who perish being tormented in hell, but we'll be glad about it. In fact, Tertullian thought we'd be rejoicing about it. I hardly think that makes sense, since God himself doesn't rejoice in it. In fact, the Bible says he has no pleasure in the death of the wicked. So how would we, once we are more like him than we are now, and no doubt more loving than we are now, how could we be so cruel as to rejoice in the sufferings of others, even if we recognize them as just? I had a cousin who went to prison for his crimes and committed suicide in prison, and he was a good friend of mine when we were kids growing up. It grieved me. I knew that going to prison was, you know, he deserved it. He deserved it actually worse, because he had done many crimes he hadn't gone to prison for. And then, of course, he killed himself, which is a terrible thing, but that's on him. You know, it's not like he's a victim of something, but I still feel awfully sorry. I'm still grieved about him. And, you know, even if eternal punishment was entirely just, I would still grieve over it. I wouldn't be happy about it, and so would God. This is one of the things, one of many things that make me have questions about whether the Bible really teaches such a thing as the traditional view of hell. There are two other views of hell that have been held historically, and
Yes. Each
of them would be somewhat more palatable. Of course, one of them is that the wicked are simply eventually annihilated, and they don't suffer anymore. They don't go to heaven, and they don't suffer. And in that case, it would be a very sad thing. For example, I have some very close friends and relatives that are lost at this point. And if they died in that condition, it'd be a very sad thing for me to think of them being annihilated ultimately, but I wouldn't have to think about them suffering eternally, and that would be a very different thing. I mean, if people simply cease to exist in hell because they get annihilated, as some people say, well, then that wouldn't be much more hard to bear than putting down a faithful dog, you know, in a sense. I mean, not that people and dogs are the same, but if they don't experience anything more after they die, you're sad. It's someone you loved. You wish they wouldn't have to die. But once they're dead, you get over it and you move on. And it's like when Old Yeller was shot because he got rabies in the movie. When you cry when you're a kid about that, but you get over it. And even the kid in the real movie, if it was his real dog, would have gotten it over it too, like all of us have lost pets. But we don't think of them as being tormented eternally. That would be rather hard to bear no matter how long we lived. You wouldn't really get over that very easily. So some people think that the annihilation view is more biblical. And, of course, there's the third view that hell is a place where God actually does give people additional chances to repent and will restore them if they do. I'm not advocating any of these views because they all have some biblical support that can be drawn in their favor. And all of them have the support of church fathers in the first four centuries. So, you know, there's more than one view of hell available. I think the one that Tertullian had is the most gross and the most cruel, because that is the eternal conscious torment view, and his view was that we'll rejoice to see them suffering. I can hardly imagine that'd be true, because even God himself wouldn't rejoice over that.
Yeah, I have to be honest, I had the same gross thought, and that's the traditional view. It never sat well with me, so I was very grateful when I found your program. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh my God, someone else who doesn't like that as much as me.
Yeah.
So I've got your book, I just haven't had a chance to read it.
Okay. Yeah, it's not just I don't like it. I mean, who could like it? I don't think anyone would like it. I guess some people do. Some of the books I read when I was writing my book on hell, some of the guys who wrote the traditional view did seem to relish it. They did relish the idea of sinners being tormented forever, but most of them said it's a horrible thing, we wish it didn't have to be so, and so forth. In fact, a few of them even said, that, you know, like C.H. Spurgeon and a few others have said, even God doesn't like hell, even God hates hell. But then you wonder, if he hates it, why did he create it? You know, I mean, he didn't have to, no one made him do it. So, you know, it's a more complicated subject than it has been presented to us in the past. And you mentioned having my book. For listeners who don't, I have a book I wrote called All You Want to Know About Hell, Three Christian Views. And I do examine all three views, their scriptural merits and their scriptural demerits, as it were, and the history of thinking about hell in the church. I would suggest, as you are concerned about this very question that you raised, and I would be too, that you do take the time to read the book, and I think it'll be very helpful to you.
Oh, I plan to, but it was on my heart lately because I'm like you, I have a family member who has done some really bad things, and
sure.
I don't even know where he's at right now, but being honest, I pray for him every night.
You know, I want to just say, I'm so busy, and I travel so much that I don't get as much time for reading as I wish. And nowadays, probably half the books I read, I do on audiobook. You know, there's a Christian audio app where you get all kinds of good books. And I'm just after the show today, I think I'm going to have a conversation with them. I've got an appointment to talk to a guy there about getting my hell book to be available as an audiobook. And I think that's a lot easier to get through, because when you're driving and stuff, you can listen to it, and when you don't have time to read much. Yeah.
I hope it works.
I do too. I'll let you know.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Cheryl. God bless you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye now. All right. Our next caller then is Everett from Sacramento, California. Everett, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. Okay. The line is activated. Everett, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Steve. Thank you so much.
Okay, great.
Yes, I'm from San Pablo. But my question is, when it deals with God sitting on the throne in heaven, and it says the Lamb came and took the book out of the right hand of him that sat upon the throne, yes. And then Jesus makes a statement to one of the churches. He says, to him that overcometh will I grant to sit with me in my throne. Can you describe this throne in terms of what it means by God sitting on the throne, sitting with Christ on the throne? Because we all can't be sitting on the throne. I mean, you know. So,
right.
I want to get your ideas on that.
Okay, that's great. I'll be glad to talk about that. In the book of Revelation, what we have are symbolic visions. And they sometimes if you took them literally, they would seem to contradict each other. For example, in chapter 1, we have Jesus holding in his right hand the seven stars, which are the seven churches. And then a couple verses later, he puts his right hand on John's head, John who's fallen on his face as one dead. He puts his right hand on John's head. Well, that's where the seven stars are supposed to be. You know, did they fall out of his hand or what? You know, you're not necessarily supposed to be picturing this as something physical and tangible, but the visions are symbolic. They're conveying ideas in symbolic form, and you really can't put them all together, you know, in a consistent way, literally. Like in chapter 5 of Revelation, God is on the throne, and the Lamb is not. And the Lamb, you know, steps up, and he that's on the throne hands the seven-sealed scroll to the Lamb, who is not on the throne. But as you said, in Revelation 3:21, Jesus said, anyone who overcomes will sit with me on my throne as I have overcome, and I'm seated with my Father on his throne. So is he on the throne or is he not? It is seen one way, yes. In another vision, he's not seen there. Similarly, in chapter 19, you read that, you know, the bride of the Lamb, the wife of the Lamb, has made herself ready, and the wedding feast has come. And then it pronounces a blessing on those who are invited to the feast. And that's us, but we're the bride too. I mean, you kind of, it's like a mixed metaphor in the marriage image. We're like the guest and we're like the bride, and which could not be true if it was literal. But Revelation, no early reader of Revelation in the first century would ever dream of taking it literally. They would recognize it for what it is. It's like the book of Daniel. It's like the book of Zechariah. It's an apocalyptic book, and the visions are no more literal than Pilgrim's Progress is literal story, you know, or the Lion and the Witch and the Wardrobe are a literal story. This is a literary style where ideas were conveyed through pictures. And so to say that even God sits on a throne, of course, that idea is found in the Psalms and in the Old Testament, Ezekiel and so forth, too. But even so, God is not a body. He doesn't have a seat to sit on a chair. He's a spirit. He's everywhere. He's not located in one spot on a chair, but he is the king. And for someone to sit on a throne or to wear crowns, these are images the Bible uses to speak of their sovereignty. We think of an earthly king sitting on a throne and wearing a crown, and that's why that image is used to portray God as a king. God is one who's sovereign. But that God literally sits on a decorated chair up in the sky is probably not to be a thought to be encouraged as a literal thought. And so to say that Jesus is seated with his Father on his throne, I personally think that that's symbolic. It just means that he's reigning with his Father. And then, of course, in chapter 5 of Revelation, when his Father is on the throne, he holds this scroll and hands it to the Lamb, who's not on the throne. That's conveying another idea. It's not denying that Jesus is reigning with his Father. It's just suggesting that his Father is handing down to him an assignment to break these seven seals and open the scroll and execute the judgment. So we have to be very careful, because we don't write books in the apocalyptic style that Revelation and Daniel and Zechariah are written in, and many other books that are not in our Bible that the Jews read. Very common method of writing, but it's not common among us, and therefore, since we take things more literally in our culture, we have to really remind ourselves this was not written to Americans in the 21st century. This was written to ancient Jews 2,000 years ago, who thought differently about this kind of literature, and we should ask what was being communicated to them. That's the question. Anyway,
right. For example, when it talks about when he opened the sixth seal, he saw the sun became as black as sackcloth of hair, the moon became as blood, the stars of heaven fell onto the earth. That can't be taken literally, because that would be such a
First of all, you can't literally have stars fall to the earth, because the earth is smaller than any star. You know, that's like saying that a basketball fell into a BB. You know, it can't happen. It's a figure of speech, and it's the same figure of speech that's used in Isaiah 13:10 when it talks about the fall of ancient Babylon. The sun was dark and the moon didn't give her life. The stars fell. Likewise, the fall of Egypt to the Babylonians is described that way in Ezekiel 32. The heavens being rolled up like a scroll and the stars falling like figs from a fig tree is a description of the fall of Edom 6 centuries before Christ. In Isaiah 34. So or Isaiah 32, excuse me. And so, I mean, this imagery is very common in the prophets. What isn't common is for modern Christians to read the prophets enough to even understand what they do and how they speak. Anyone who takes time to study the prophets should become acquainted with the typical figures of speech they use. And the dissolving of the universe, the darkening of the sun, moon, and stars, the collapse of the solar system, these things are all symbols for the end of a great empire. Sometimes it's Babylon, sometimes it's Egypt, sometimes it's Jerusalem. Hey, I need to take a break here, but I hope that helps you, brother. Thanks for joining us. We're going to have another half hour ahead of us, so stay online if you're waiting to call in. So we do have people waiting. But we have to take a break for the sake of saying goodbye to those who will not be with us for the second half hour. And some of those are listening to stations that don't carry our second half hour. Most of our stations do. Now, though we're going on for half hour, I want to say that those of you who are leaving can hear the whole program from our website, thenarrowpath.com, or from the mobile app, thenarrowpath.com, which you can get for your device. We are listener supported. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can donate from the website if you wish at thenarrowpath.com. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
As you know, the Narrow Path radio show is Bible radio that has nothing to sell you but everything to give you. So do the right thing and share what you know with your family and friends. Tell them to tune in to the Narrow Path on this radio station or go to thenarrowpath.com where they will find topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all the radio shows. You know listeners supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Share what you know.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live taking your phone calls if you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith. I will say right now our lines are full, so if you call our number, you'll get a busy signal. But let me give you the number anyway, because in a few minutes, lines will be opening up, and you will be able to get through if you try. The number is 844-484-5737. Remember, you won't be able to get through right now if you call because the lines are busy. But you will be able to get through in a few minutes in all likelihood if you have this number ready, 844-484-5737. Our next caller is Kyle from Dallas, Texas. Kyle, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. I'm not super familiar with your program. I'm actually a first-time listener today.
Oh, great.
And a first-time caller.
Welcome.
So I have two questions. One will be very simple, probably, and the second one is a much deeper situation that I'm interested in your scholarship on. The first one is what denominational influence do you most closely align with right now? And then secondly, and more deeply, my son about 3 years ago totally disassociated himself from our family and, in fact, changed his name legally from mine. And it's been a very difficult situation. And my question is apart from perhaps a reference to the prodigal son, what is there for me to rest on other than my prayer and path towards forgiveness and leaning on the Holy Spirit to get me through this?
Well, let me say, first of all, since you're a new listener, you don't know much about me, but I have some of my own children who are prodigals at this time. So I know how hurtful that is. Let me answer your first question first. As far as denominations I align with, I haven't been a part of a denomination since 1970, but I was raised in the Baptist church. Of course, that doesn't tell you much because there's 40 different denominations of Baptist, you know.
Right.
The church my family raised me in was an American Baptist, which happens to be the most liberal of Baptist denominations, but we weren't liberal. My parents were very conservative. I was very conservative. We didn't know it was a liberal Baptist denomination. We kind of thought all Baptists were the same, and it was just the First Baptist Church of our town. So we were actually in a Baptist church, but like I say, of all Baptist denominations, I think the most liberal is the one we were in. But we were very conservative, very fundamentalist. I associate with Calvary Chapel in Costa Mesa during the Jesus Movement starting in 1970. And so very, very much influenced by Chuck Smith, and he was my pastor for 5 years in the early 70s. I later moved away where there wasn't a Calvary Chapel and just mainly studied on my own. I went to what church, you know, non-denominational churches here and there. And I've always been in non-denominational churches since then. My theology aligns, well, it's eclectic. Some people in Reformed theology will find affinity with me because I'm amillennial. But they won't find affinity with me in that I'm not Calvinistic. I'm not a Calvinist, but I am I'm not dispensationalist. So, you know, Reformed would agree with me on some things and not on other things. Calvary Chapel would not agree with me on my eschatology today. But they would agree that in not being Calvinistic. So, you know, there's different groups I would share some things with. The Church of God of Anderson, Indiana is a denomination I've never really been a part of, and there's not, I don't even think there's a church of that denomination where I live, but I know that they have similar, they are also amillennial and not Calvinistic, which would be agreeable with me, but they're cessationists. They don't believe the gifts of the Spirit continue past the time of the apostles, so I would not share that view. So I'm really quite eclectic. I'm not Calvinist. I'm not dispensational. And I'm not cessationist. I don't believe the gifts have ceased. So that would be a strange combination. And I don't know that that aligns with any particular denomination that I'm aware of. Now, as far as your son, this is a very heartbreaking situation, and I know because I've been through it. I have five children, and each of them in their turn has gone through a stage of being alienated from me. They're not all in that condition now. I'm on good terms with most of them now, but there's still at least one who's fairly, you know, alienated. He hasn't changed his name or anything like that, but he changed his first name. He didn't change his last name. He's still a Greg. But, you know, it's, you know, all these kids were Christians growing up. These kids loved the Lord. They wanted to be missionaries. They were Bible reading, you know, hymn singing, music. They're musicians and artists. They're brilliant, or they were once brilliant kids. Some of them have compromised their brain cells with substances since then, and they're not quite as brilliant as they once were. But it's a hard thing to see kids that were so promising up into their teens who have been allured, you know, by the world. And I don't know what to tell you except, A, you know, which everyone will tell you, you got to pray for them. You got to fight for them. That doesn't mean you have to chase them. They do need to know that you want them. But as in the case of the prodigal son, the father didn't chase his son down. He let circumstances take their course. You know, sometimes when our kids get away from us, they get into trouble, and then we want to help them out. Want to bail them out of jail or pay their rent for them because they've wasted their money on something else. And, you know, we want them to have a phone so we can reach them. So we pay their phone bill when it gets turned off and stuff. And that's not really what we should be doing, in my opinion. I mean, God might lead you to do that once in a while. You really have to do what God leads you to do. But I really think that sometimes we just really have to, you know, tough up and say, this is hurting me probably more than it's hurting them. But I've got to be the adult, and I've got to bear the pain and let God deal with them. Of course, every contact they have with us, if they have it, should be loving on our part. We should always be loving, but not compromising, you know. And
two quick thoughts. One, I was reading that at least in the world of psychology and counseling and therapy, that this is a huge problem right now, that it people are totally excising themselves from families, and it's a wildfire, and that's very alarming to me from a society perspective. And then the second perspective is, as parents, we feel, I know that the Lord puts us through circumstances that he himself feels as a heavenly parent to us, because we have rejected him, and we go years and years often without thinking of him or worried about him or having communion with him.
And you know, Kyle,
certainly, yes.
I just want to say that Paul said in Philippians chapter 2, I want to know Christ in the fellowship of his sufferings and in the power of his resurrection. To fellowship with God, to fellowship with Christ in the fellowship of his sufferings means that we get to know aspects of him by suffering the same kinds of things he suffered. I remember my first wife, I got married when I was a teenager, and my first wife didn't stay with the Lord or with me or with her child. She left me and the child and the Lord. But before she left, she was doing things with other guys. And it was a very painful marriage for me. And I remember praying and saying, God, you know, I read in the Bible that Jesus was tempted in all ways like we are, and yet he never married. You've never had to put up with an adulterous wife. And then I had to correct myself. Wait a minute, I guess that's not true, is it? You have, you know. God had to put up with Israel's adultery. She was his wife. And even Christ has had to put up with the church that has gone very far astray in many cases. And I realized that, and I thought, all right, so me going through this is just another way in which I can feel God's pain in a way. I mean, it's fellowshipping with him. If you embrace it as such, just say, well, you know, God is allowing this to happen. He could do something to change it, but he's allowing it to happen in my life so that I can know something about him more, and I will actually connect with him in a different, a deeper level. I really believe that is true, and that's actually been my experience in life, in all the trials I've been through. And I don't claim to have been through a huge number of trials. I've been through some that were fairly serious. And in all the trials I've been through, I really feel like it drives me closer to the Lord. Trials either do that or they drive you away from the Lord. Some people actually leave God because of their trials. And that's, of course, what trials are there to test. Are you loyal to God or not? In trials is where you find out. Because if you're loyal to God, then in trials, you draw nearer to him. If you're not loyal,
thanks, Steve,
the trials drive you away from him. Yeah. All right,
thanks,
Kyle, I appreciate
God
your call.
Sir.
God bless you. It's good talking to you, my brother. All right, let's talk to Doug from Sacramento, California. Doug, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I heard your call yesterday where the guy asked about the book of Jasher, and I don't know if I necessarily agree with you on that or disagree with you because I just haven't looked into it, but my question is more so like the books of Enoch and the book of Jubilees and Maccabees.
Yeah.
I know some of those are in the Catholic Bible, and some of them were in our Bible, the King James, or the Protestant Bible. I'm not sure when they were removed or why. But do you have any words on that, by chance?
Yeah, well, the Book of Jubilees and the Books of Enoch have never been in the Catholic Bible or the Protestant Bible. Those are part of the Jewish Apocrypha, but they're part of the Jewish Apocrypha that was never included in any Bible. The Books of Maccabees, you're right, 1st and 2nd Maccabees are in the Catholic Bible, though for some reason 3rd and 4th Maccabees are not. They are found in the four books of Maccabees are found in the Septuagint. And actually, the Catholics include apocryphal books sometimes on the argument that, well, they're in the Septuagint. But they're not. I mean, lots of them are not. Certainly, the book of the book of 3rd and 4th Maccabees is in the Septuagint, and the Catholics don't put it in. But there are seven books in the Catholic Bible that are not in the Protestant Bible. They're all Old Testament era books. They're before the time of Christ. And they are all written between Malachi's time and Jesus' time. Now, there's a 400-year gap but after Malachi, the last book of our Old Testament, and the time of John the Baptist and Jesus in the New Testament. There's a 400-year gap. This is sometimes called the intertestamental period, and it's a time where there's no record of God sending any prophets to Israel. There were a lot of prophets in the earlier days, and their books, insofar as they've survived, are in our Old Testament. But there are a number of books the Jews wrote, but they weren't written by prophets. They were not written by inspired writers. They were historians and inspirational writers who would be maybe analogous to, an inspirational writer today, like My Utmost for His Highest, or maybe...
Pardon?
Oh, so you're talking to somebody else. Okay. So the thing is that Protestants only recognize as books of the Bible books that are written either by inspired prophets or by apostles and their near associates, because the apostles were specially authorized by Christ to be his spokespersons, and the prophets in the Old Testament were inspired by God. And so if something's written by one of God's prophets or one of Christ's apostles, it's acceptable. Now, the seven books of the Apocrypha that are in the Catholic Bible and not in the Protestant Bible, nobody even pretends that they were written by prophets or apostles. The writers were just historians or fictional writers. And they don't claim to be inspired. They don't claim, even the Catholic Bible doesn't consider them to be the same as the other books in their Bible. They see them as deuterocanonical, meaning that they actually are at a second level of authority below that of the other books of the Bible. Now, Luther did believe that the apocryphal books were of value, but he didn't believe they belonged in the Bible. He said they could be read for edification, but they shouldn't be mistaken for Scripture, and I agree with that.
Okay.
All right.
That makes a little more sense. Thank you.
Okay, Doug, thank you for your call. It's good talking to you. Ryan from Peru is calling. You're calling from Peru. I hope I didn't keep you on hold too long.
I am. Yeah, I'm calling from Peru.
How you doing?
I'm doing good, thanks.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So, the last time I called you was in 1998, so I figured it's been 20 years, so I should probably call again.
You weren't in Peru then, were you?
No. No.
Okay.
No, I was at the Great Commission School.
Okay. Now I've got a little more idea of who I'm talking to. Gotcha. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, my question is, I have friends that are getting into the Anagram, and I was wondering if you have any information or have any wisdom about that.
I don't know what personality test. Okay, I don't know anything about the personality test called the Anagram. The word Anagram is a term for a generic kind of a word puzzle kind of thing where the letters of words can be rearranged to spell other words. But I don't know. I'm not familiar with a personality test that's taken that as its name. Could you tell me something about it?
Well, yes, it's something that's getting bigger in I guess mainline Christianity. There's some popular teachers like Jen Hatmaker who are pushing it. And then,
what are they pushing it for? What's it for?
I'm not exactly sure, but I have friends that are in ministry, and it seems to be all they're talking about these days.
Sure. Well,
Ian Morgan Crone is an author. He wrote the, and they're saying it's like an ancient thing that that has come back to light, and it seems fishy to me. That's why I was wondering if you had
information. You know, the more ancient it is, the more suspicious I am of it, because it's not a Christian biblical thing. You know, I mean, if some ancient practices are being adopted by Christians and they're not Christian practices, usually, I mean, if you go back far enough, ancient practices all have their source in the occult. I don't know what its source is or what it's for. But I have, over the years, even when I was leading the Great Commission School, encountered people who wanted to give personality tests, or they talked about the four temperaments, or they'd give sort of a questionnaire, and then they'd tell you that you're part this temperament, part that temperament, and so forth. And then there's something that people have done very similar to try to, they call it spiritual gifts inventory. They're trying to tell people what their spiritual gift is. I've never been behind any of this. I mean, I don't care if someone wants to tell me I'm part phlegmatic and part something else, you know, sanguine. I mean, I don't even know, nor do I care. I mean, the Bible obviously doesn't place any importance on those things. And it's just one of those things, Ryan, that it's just another thing to distract people away from what matters. And what matters is being like Jesus all the time. And it seems like being like Jesus all the time is something that very few people do well. In fact, I don't know if I know anyone who does it well all the time. And yet some people who obviously aren't doing that as well as they should be, they decide to get distracted about something that has nothing to do with it. Now, if they say, well, this has something to do with it because it'll tell us something about our personality and blah, blah, blah. Well, the Bible doesn't indicate that your personality or knowing what your personality is has any relevance to being like Jesus. Being like Jesus is a result of walking in the Spirit of Christ. And the more you focus on Jesus, the more that's going to happen. Remember, it says in 2 Corinthians 3:18, as we all with unveiled faces beholding as in a mirror the glory of the Lord are changed from glory to glory into that same image. So we're being, by the Spirit of God, we're being changed to the image of Christ by looking at Jesus, not by looking at ourselves. And all of these personality tests are to tell you more about yourself. And, well, that's exactly what psychology is about, is learn more about yourself. And it's interesting, carnality is characterized by being really obsessed with myself. And, you know, spirituality is characterized by being more forgetful of myself and more concerned about Jesus and others. So whenever you start doing these personality tests and stuff, it's such an inward focus. That's what psychology always is. It's always an inward focus.
Sure.
What's wrong with me? How can I change and so forth? And yet the Bible doesn't concern itself with that. It says that when you're doing something wrong, it's because it's sin. There is a power in the Holy Spirit to walk in the Spirit and overcome sin in your life. This has very little to do with what your temperament is, or your personality. Let God know what that is. Why do you need to think about it? It's just a distraction. People are not getting more spiritual by finding new distractions, and yet Christians are continually seeking new distractions. Why should anyone concern themselves with things that Jesus didn't practice or teach, and the disciples didn't practice or teach, when in fact we're not doing that well yet, the things they did practice and teach? Why not wait until we've got that all squared away and then see if there's anything else we need to add? But again, whenever people get into that, it's invariably a distraction. It's a distraction from the focus on Christ, and therefore I would say it's from the devil, because it's the devil more than anyone who wants us distracted from Christ and to be, focused on self.
Sure. Well, sounds great. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
All right, Ryan. Hey, what are you doing down in Peru?
We run a home for abused and abandoned kids, and we're starting to plant churches and things like that.
Wonderful. Well, God bless you. It's good to hear from you today.
Yeah, thanks a lot. All right, thanks.
Don't make it so long next time. All right. Bye now. All right. Let's see. We've got Joe from Mountain View, California. Joe, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you, Steve. It's good to talk with you first time, and thank you for what you're doing.
You're welcome.
So, I enjoy learning about astronomy and space, and the Bible talks about a new heavens and a new earth coming in the new age. And I wonder if you think that means something closer to a resurrection or redemption of our existing physical universe, or a complete blank slate obliteration of our existing planets and stars, and that...
And a complete replacement.
To replace what exists.
I lean toward the former. That is, I believe that Christ is going to redeem what was lost, and he's going to make all things new. He says that in Revelation. Behold, he says, I make all things new. Now, he doesn't say I make all new things. Mm-hmm. I'm making everything new. He's going to renew everything. I'm going to make everything new again. And therefore, I don't believe that he's going to just obliterate the earth and the stars and things like that. I think he's going to purge it. I think that sin and effects of the fall came upon the earth, at a certain point in the time of Adam and Eve. And Jesus came to restore to God what was lost. And what was lost was a perfect earth with perfect humanity in it. And so in the resurrection, we'll be resurrected, physical, glorified, immortal, and perfect people. And we'll be living in a perfect physical world that doesn't have any of the effects of the fall. So that Revelation talks about, in Revelation 21:4, God will wipe every tear from their eyes. There'll be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There'll be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. No more death, no more pain. And that's in the new earth. That's not describing heaven. That's describing the new earth and the new Jerusalem. So I believe it's a physical entity. I don't think he just kind of dissolves everything completely and makes new from scratch. But the Bible does talk about the elements melting with a fervent heat. I don't know if he's going to burn off the surface of the earth to totally purge it. I don't know if he has to do that in order to accomplish the renewing of it. And I don't know how much of that is literal, you know. I don't know how much is going to be done with real, you know, normal fire and things like that. But in any case, the way I see it is there's going to be a purging, cleansing, and renewing of the earth and the removal of all the effects of the curse from the earth and from our resurrected bodies so that we'll live in the perfect earth as God always intended. That's why, if Adam and Eve had never sinned, they would never have died, and therefore they would have lived forever as God made it to be, for them to live forever in an earth that has no sin or you know, evil or anything like that. Adam and Eve sinned and changed that, but if they had not sinned, then God's purpose would have gone on interrupted, and that is for perfect people living on a perfect earth. And the Bible describes the ultimate end that Jesus is bringing about as just that, perfect people living on perfect earth.
Right. Well, great. That is comforting and encouraging, and I hope to explore God's marvelous universe.
In the new earth, I don't know exactly what things will be like, but I doubt that we'll be less sophisticated than we are now. So, I mean, if we can send people to the moon or send things to Mars, you know, I don't think we'll be less capable in the new earth. We may be infinitely more so. You know, it's hard to know how far we would be along technologically and how much of space we would have explored more if there'd never been a fall and you know, if people hadn't compromised their personalities and their character for sin. So, I mean, we'll just find out. I mean, one thing is for sure, it's going to be a lot better than now. And it may be, you know, some people think we'll be actually able to do space travel. I mean, there's some reason all those bodies are out there. We don't know exactly what that reason is, but we'll find out.
Great. Thanks so much. Good talking with you.
All right. Thank you very much. God bless you. You know, Jeff from San Francisco is on, but we don't have very much more than a minute or two. Jeff, can we be real quick about this?
Yeah. Hi, Steve. It was great to see you in Sacramento.
Yeah, that's not being quick. What's your question?
Oh, yeah, no, I understand. That's not going to be much time, so I'm just going to change my question. Feeling a little down. A couple of your callers brought me down. The second caller with that question and the other people with the son abandoning the family. It's just, you know, you always want things to turn out good in the end. So I'll just ask you a quick question. It's are you familiar with the Jerusalem syndrome?
I'm not sure I've heard it by name. What is it?
It's this phenomenon where people feel they're being mysteriously called by God to come to Israel, especially Jerusalem. And
I've certainly known a lot of people who've told me they feel that drawn to do that, but I don't remember it being called the Jerusalem syndrome particularly. But what are your thoughts about it?
I had it back in 2000. I thought Jesus was going to return, so I went to Israel. And I was going to go to Jerusalem, but at the time they were having the Intifada, you know, with the Palestinians.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The cab driver recommended I don't go. It wasn't a good time, so I stayed in Tel Aviv.
Okay. Well, I wish we could hear more about that, but we're out of time for today. I appreciate your call. Maybe next time you're home we'll have more time. I'm sorry to put you on so late. We're out of time for the day and for the week. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, that's what keeps us on the air. You can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. The website is full of resources. They're all free. You can donate there if you want to. It's The Narrow Path. Have a great weekend, and let's talk again Monday. God bless you.